consequence. I don't know if I can agree with that. Van smiled.
Nor should you. It's something a person should only conclude about himself. All other lives are precious.
Doc shook his head in reluctant admiration. When this is over, sir, I'd fancy a long conversation with you, maybe over a beer if that's your thing. You seem to have an interesting and admirable philosophy, but for now, I have a job to do, and I need your information to do it.
Van put his hands together in a sampea. I would very much enjoy that conversation. As for my information, in talking with you just now about the usual places, the expected places, well, now that I'm about to tell you, I almost feel silly, because I realize it's really just a hunch.
No, no, believe me, I learned something valuable from someone just recently that started with nothing but a hunch. Don't think about it. Just say it.
All right. About 6 months ago, a consortium of developers built a 5-star hotel in Pattaya called Ruby with a massive nightclub called Les Nuits. This is part of an ongoing effort to rebrand Pattaya. First there was Sleaze, then there was the attempt to brand the area as something for a wholesome family vacation, and now there's an attempt to combine the two with upscale clubs like Les Nuits.
Pattaya was a beach town about a 2-hour drive southeast of Bangkok, known for its profusion of beer bars and go-go clubs, and though he hadn't been there in years, Docs had gotten to know it well enough back in the day.
Sure, he said, a little like the evolution of Las Vegas.
Yes, the American Sin City is in fact a model for the Pattaya town fathers. At any rate, there were some indications at the time that one of Sorm's front companies had invested in the project as a money laundering scheme, but we were never able to uncover anything concrete. And I decided that our information was faulty because Sorm's practice was to invest in smaller, lower profile and more déclassé establishments, and mostly in Bangkok and Phuket. But now...
Now?
Now I'm wondering, if Sorm is in hiding, Ruby would be the kind of place I wouldn't expect. Certainly we made no mention of it in the indictment. He would have protection there, probably a lot of it. It would be comfortable. It would be... Well, as I said, it's just a hunch. I doubt there's anything that could be done with it.
Hell, Mr. Van, I know low people in high places and high people in low places. You'd be surprised what I can do with a hunch like yours.
Chapter 9. 3 mornings after her conversation with Lieutenant Strangeland, Livia was in a cab en route to St. Clair Hospice northeast of Bangkok, part of the Franciscan Foundation of Thailand, a haven for indigents gripped by the final ravages of AIDS, one of whom, it seemed, was Squarehead. Her decision to approach Squarehead first was based on the simple fact that the Homeland Security database didn't list a mobile phone number for Dirty Beard. But Squarehead's mobile was known, and Livia still had the Gossamer cell phone tracker she had permanently borrowed from SPD inventory. She had checked out one of the units, then returned the machine press crushed remains of her replica, claiming to have dropped it on the tracks at a Seattle Link Light rail station just as the train was pulling in. The department had 6 of them, purchased with a grant from Homeland Security, as it happened, the formidable units all tightly controlled pursuant to a contract with the manufacturer. Alvin, the head of police inventory, had a crush on her and was happy to fill out the paperwork explaining the accident and requisitioning a replacement. Which meant Livia had her own handheld cell phone tracker, sensitive enough to place a phone to within a yard of its actual location and to listen in on calls. She had used it to track Senator Lone to his hotel room in Bangkok, and as soon as she checked into a business hotel in Sathorn after arriving from Seattle, she had used it to locate Squarehead. The thought of him slowly eaten alive by disease was enormously pleasing, because he deserved it, of course, but also because, with just a little luck, it would make him more vulnerable. If she couldn't manipulate him, she didn't know how she would get to Dirty Beard, or Sorm, or find that little girl. Once they were clear of metropolitan Bangkok, the landscape changed dramatically. The cluttered canyons of concrete, the congestion of untold thousands of cars and tuk-tuks and motorcycles, the metastasized tangles of electric wires, all suddenly leveling off almost with a sigh, replaced by a far-reaching flat landscape of green rice paddies and a vast, pale blue sky. The windows of the cab were open, and for the second time in as many months, the smell of the air, the colors of the earth and sky, it all stirred powerful feelings of her childhood, nostalgia, sadness, grief, regret. She had spent her adulthood convinced the girl she had been was gone, the child cut off, the amputation site cauterized. It seemed this country insisted on proving her wrong. About an hour outside Bangkok, they came to a modest road sign, so small as to be deliberately humble, with a message in Thai and English saying, "Garden of Gospel Peace, Franciscan Friars, 4 kilometers. The anxiety Livia had been keeping at the periphery pushed in harder, and she felt her heart begin to kick from an adrenaline hit. She closed her eyes and breathed slowly and deeply, the way she had learned to do before judo matches, the way she always did while hunting a rapist. This time, though, it barely helped. She was about to face a monster from her childhood, and everything else she needed to accomplish depended on success with him. They turned off the 2-lane blacktop and followed an older, rutted road, bleached gray by the sun. Other than 2 cars and a single motor scooter, they passed nothing but grass and swaying palm trees. It was a bucolic setting, detached, dreamy, and peaceful, and it was easy to see why the Franciscans would have chosen it. But the incongruity between the ambiance and what Livia was here for made her anxiety worse. "Come on, girl. It's a good plan. You've done this before. You've always made it work. Just breathe. Breathe." After a few minutes along the rutted road, they came to another sign, again in Thai and English. "Friary, Retreat House, St. Clair Hospice." Arrows indicated that the friary was one way, the retreat house and hospice the other. The cab followed the sign to the retreat house. They passed a sala, the small Thai pavilion, under which stood a life-sized statue of St. Francis, one hand open in welcome, the other holding a dove. Beyond it was a simple white building with a red-tiled roof. A sign read, "Retreat House." She paid the driver, shouldered her backpack, discreetly used a bandana to pull the door handle, and got out of the cab, her damp shirt clinging to her back. She waited under the portico of the building for a minute, watching the cab head off, getting into character. She was a backpacker, visiting Thailand from San Francisco. In reality, she was 31, but she could pass for considerably younger, and right now, in her cargo shorts, t-shirt, light hiking boots, and boonie hat, she knew she looked like someone recently out of grad school, traveling on the cheap for a while before figuring out her next move. The clothes and backpack were all new, purchased in Bangkok just the day before, in fact, but she'd been sure to scuff the shoes and rub dirt into the pack and otherwise give everything a lived-in look that would pass anything less than a careful inspection. And the non-prescription horn-rimmed glasses she had on did a lot to alter her appearance generally. When the cab had disappeared around a bend in the road and she felt like who she was supposed to be, she walked inside, finding a long room stretching left and right, empty but for dozens of chairs lining the walls. There was nothing remotely fancy about the facility, but it was clean and looked well cared for. In contrast to the heat and glare outside, the air was pleasantly cool and dry, the walls and floor illuminated only by rays of light coming softly through the windows. A ceiling fan spun lazily overhead. The space felt like a sanctuary. A young Thai man in a brown habit was sitting behind a plain wooden desk facing the entrance. He stood when he saw her, pressed his palms together in a Y, and said in Thai-accented English, "Welcome to the Garden of Gospel Peace." Livia used a heel to close the door, then returned the Y and approached the desk, her footfalls echoing off the tiled floor. "My name is Andrea," she said. "Andrea Brown. I made a reservation online." "Oh, yes, Miss Brown. I am Brother Panit. I have your reservation right here. For 2 nights, 1 person, one of the small rooms with air conditioning. Is that correct?"
"Yes, that's correct."
"Half the payment is due upon check-in, the other half 1 day before check-out. So tomorrow."
"Of course. Why don't I just pay it all right now?"
She was carrying thousands of dollars worth of greenbacks and bought. She expected there was a lot she would have to buy during the week and wanted to be able to do so anonymously. Now she took 1,500 baht from one of the pockets in her shorts and placed it on the desk. About $22 a night, a bargain for an opportunity to indulge in a little solitude and quiet contemplation. Or to interrogate and kill one of the men who raped you and your sister when you were children. "Thank you, Ms. Andrea," the man said, placing the baht in one of the desk drawers. It was a small thing, but still bewildering, in a good way, to be a Seattle cop suddenly in a world where, without a second thought, people left cash in unsecured drawers. Brother Panit escorted her across a pedestrian bridge spanning a fish pond, through a garden filled with chirping birds, and along a stone path to a small, solitary bungalow. The door was unlocked, and Livia was careful to touch nothing as they went inside, just as she had been at the reception center. The space was spartan. Plaster walls, two single cots, a writing desk, a plain wooden chair. The bathroom was just big enough to contain a stall shower and a toilet. Brother Panit closed the door behind them, and suddenly the world was noiseless, even the buzzing of insects gone. "Everything is so quiet," Livia said. Brother Panit smiled. "Always, but especially now, because hot season in Thailand not as popular to visitors, but all times the retreat is for meditative stroll and meditative sitting in gardens. You can pass hours being with tropical tree and nature flower beauty. So, yes, very quiet place. Peaceful." "And no security cameras," Livia thought. "Why would there be, in a place where they leave doors unlocked and cash in unattended desk drawers?" She noted that his syntax, which had been natural, presumably because their initial exchange about the room was rote, had grown strained as their interaction progressed. "Thank you," Livia said. "And you have a hospice here, too, don't you?" "Oh, yes. St. Clare, named for Clare of Assisi, one of St. Francis's first followers." "Who are your patients?" "The poor who are in the final stages of AIDS. St. Francis's path to God lay in his compassion for lepers. Today we embrace our patients with that same love and happiness." The syntax was natural again, so apparently they were back on familiar ground. He was accustomed to discussing the hospice with visitors to the retreat, meaning her inquiries wouldn't feel unusual to him or memorable. "I had a friend who died of AIDS," Livia said. This wasn't technically true, but she'd worked with victims forced to live with AIDS transmitted by the men who raped them. "Thank you for what you do here. I think you must ease a lot of suffering." The initial statement might have been untrue, but the accompanying sentiment was heartfelt. Brother Panit offered a sigh of acknowledgement. "I am sorry for your friend. If you would like, you are free to visit the hospice. Only a few of our patients receive visitors. Mostly the world shuns them, as it once did lepers. For such people, just to have a conversation can be a great comfort, and many of our guests find a visit to the hospice to be the most rewarding part of their stay. As we like to say, work is love made visible." Again, the natural syntax, like something memorized from a brochure for frequent use. "Of course," Livia said. "Thank you for suggesting it." Once Brother Panit had taken his leave, Livia inventoried the contents of the pack. Mostly it was just spare clothes and a few toiletries. The relevant items were even fewer, and all sealed in individual plastic bags, a long-sleeved sweatshirt, two back issues of Rider magazine, Motorcycling at its Best, a roll of duct tape, and a pair of motocross gloves with wrist protection and carbon fiber finger and knuckle inserts. None of it would be incriminating if anyone were to see it, and all of it was explainable by virtue of her enthusiasm for riding and plans to rent a bike sometime on her trip. Still, after changing into the sweatshirt, she took the pack with her. If things developed quickly, she wanted to be in a position to improvise and not have to run back to the bungalow for her gear. And if things went sideways, she wanted to be able to leave just as quickly. She checked the gossamer and confirmed that Squarehead's phone was at the hospice, less than 100 yards from where she stood. She wanted to go straight there, but that might seem strange. so she forced herself to eat a light buffet lunch included in the room charge. She kept on the boonie hat, not much of a disguise, but along with the eyeglasses, not useless either. Sunglasses would have been better, but there was a fine line between obscuring your features naturally and drawing attention by overdoing it. Like the reception area, the dining room was illuminated only by the natural light coming through its windows. There were three other people inside, two women sitting together and a man by himself, all young, probably Aussies or Kiwis, all looking like trekkers. Livia nodded in acknowledgement and sat alone with a plate of rice and vegetables and a bottled water. She had a cover story prepared in case she had to engage anyone, but it was better to make as few contacts as possible. And in a place built for solitude and quiet meditation, a little aloofness was natural enough. After lunch, she spent some time strolling the gardens. They really were startlingly peaceful, devoid of the sounds of traffic, construction, conversation, or any other human activity, noiseless beyond the buzz of insects and the chirping of birds. Birdsong would forever remind her of Nassan, who had been such an uncanny mimic as a girl, and though she knew it was silly, the feeling that Nassan was somehow with her, keeping faith with her, still needing her, was always a comfort, and especially now. She imagined how she would appear to a casual observer, nothing more than a visitor to the retreat, strolling and lost in thought. Satisfied, she started reviewing her plan, imagining every way it could be interrupted or otherwise go wrong, devising improvisations. She had already done all of this, of course, but planning based on a map or its equivalent was one thing. Everything always needed to be refined after contact with the actual terrain. The sun was well past its zenith when she emerged from the shade of the garden trees and followed a series of signs along snaking gravel paths to St. Clair Hospice, to Squarehead. "I've found him, little bird," she thought, "and I'll use him to find the others." If anything, the hospice was even greener and more peaceful than the retreat. It consisted of a series of white buildings with red-tiled roofs, all connected by walking paths lined with potted flowers and interspersed with shimmering ponds and copses of palm trees. She passed patients in hospital gowns playing board games, listening to a sermon from a friar in brown habit who looked Indian or Sri Lankan, receiving physical therapy from attendants in blue scrubs. Some of the patients, hunched and emaciated, were being pushed in wheelchairs by their healthier-looking peers. A few people nodded or waved, but no one paid her undue attention. It seemed Brother Panit was right. It wasn't unusual for guests of the retreat to also visit the hospice. In one of the gardens, a Thai man, who was probably her age but looked at least twice that, with shrunken features and overbright eyes, gave her a weary wave and a wan smile. "Hello," he called out in Thai accent in English. "Hello, where are you from?" Even debilitated as he was, he'd made her instantly as a foreigner. Her features were local, but her posture, her gait, her overall presence, it all gave her away. It wasn't as bad as if she'd been a statuesque blonde, of course, but still, she would need local exposure and practice if she really wanted to blend. She walked over and shared her cover story with the man, visiting from San Francisco after grad school. His English was poor, and she sensed he understood little of what she said, but having her engage him in pleasantries seemed to make him happy, as Brother Panit had said would be the case, and for a moment his reaction eased her anxiety about facing Squarehead. Besides, it never did any harm to practice a cover story, especially with someone unlikely to understand or to remember the details. After a while, she excused herself and found a bathroom, where she removed the sweatshirt, took the magazines from her pack, duct-taped them around her bare forearms, and pulled the sweatshirt back on. Then she reshouldered the pack and made her way to one of the white buildings. None of the doors was closed, let alone locked, and in fact, there were no signs of any security whatsoever. And why would there be? What kind of security was required at a leper colony? The building contained a single rectangular room, three hospital cots along either side. Despite the open doors, the air smelled strongly of soap and disinfectant, none of it quite enough to conceal the odors of urine and disease beneath. All the beds were empty save two adjacent at the far end on her left. She walked slowly up the center, her heart pounding. In the near bed was a woman, a blue gown loose as a sheet over her wasted body. Her eyes were closed and she was twitching slightly, whether from a dream or a disease, Livia didn't know. In the bed beyond that was Squarehead. He lay on his back, slightly twisted away from her, both legs bent sharply, one against the bed, the other vertical. His body was skeletal beneath a formless blue gown, emaciation rendering his overlarge head more prominent than ever. His nose was hollowed out above a taped-on oxygen tube, his eyes enormous in their sockets, his knees and ankles giant bulbs connected by calfless shins. Beneath his gown, she could make out the outline of a diaper, too far gone, it seemed, even for a bedpan. For a surprising instant, she felt sympathy, compassion. And then she felt the memory of Nassan shoved back into the shipping container where they were held, bleeding and catatonic from the rape, and she felt a hot surge of satisfaction, a sweet, cruel joy at his misery. She forced herself to wall off the emotion. To get what she needed from this man, she had to be her cop self. She was here for information. She was interrogating a suspect. To that end, she would use all her skill and exploit all his weaknesses, and allow herself to feel nothing about his crimes until she'd extracted what she needed from him. At that point, she wouldn't need to be a cop anymore. She could be something else. The other thing. The dragon. She approached the bed, the soles of her hiking boots squeaking slightly on the linoleum floor, the room silent but for the hum of a few medical machines and the whoosh of a fan by one of the doors. When she reached the bed, she stopped. He turned his head slowly and looked at her. A long, sibilant exhalation escaped him, and his wasted body seemed to slacken and settle farther into the bed. He groaned something in Thai.
English, Livia said. I know you speak it. You dealt with Hammerhead getting me and Nassan to Portland.
There was a pause. Then he took a breath and whispered in English.
I knew you would come. I knew.
Even aged and wasted and deformed as he was, there was enough of the face she remembered to take her back to the cold and the wind of the deck on that boat, the artificial turf biting into her knees, and the stink of curry on all of them as, one after the other, they made her do the disgusting thing, making her believe if she did it, she could save Nassan. She felt the dragon struggling, trying to get to the surface, to take back everything they had stolen from her.
Not yet. Not yet. Not yet.
She forced herself back into cop mode. This man was about to incriminate himself, maybe even to confess. There was nothing more critical in an interview than properly documenting a confession. She realized there might be a use to which she could put his. She pulled the burner phone she'd purchased in Bangkok from her cargo shorts, switched it to video, and held it unobtrusively alongside the cot.
What do you mean? She said.
He shook his head feebly.
It was wrong. I'm sorry. All I've done. Terrible things. I'm sorry.
Even beyond her personal connection, she was sufficiently familiar with jailhouse conversions, and particularly death row conversions, to remain unmoved. On the other hand, how long did Squarehead have? Days? Weeks, if that? What did he have to gain by pretending?
All right. Assume he's sincere. Exploit that. If it was all so terrible, she said, why did you do it?
Chanchai. It was Chanchai. So afraid of him. All of us.
Chanchai Vivavapit, the man she would forever think of as Skullface.
Are you really going to blame what you did on someone else? She asked, feeling in control again, feeling like a cop.
Is that what you mean when you say you're sorry?
After you cut his eye, he... crazy. We should have stopped. Shouldn't have done. I'm sorry. I wish...
His head rolled for a moment as though he was lost, and then he recovered himself.
I wish I could do again. Everything. I wish I could be better. The boy I was. The boy my parents.
He didn't go on, but she sensed an opening.
Where are your parents now? Don't they visit you?
He groaned.
Don't want them to see me like this. To see my karma.
She logged that for later use.
Why did you take me and my sister? Why us?
Chanchai knew. Chanchai told us.
Told you what?
We supposed to. Senator wanted you.
That tracked with what she knew.
But how? How did you find us? You had a photograph of my sister and me. How did you get it? Who told you the senator wanted us?
I don't know. Chanchai told us. Chanchai.
Damn it. It was maddening to be this close and yet still unable to get the pieces she needed.
What about Sorm? Where can I find him?
At this, his eyes seemed to brighten with fear.
I never know Sorm. Even Chanchai never know. Sorm is devil.
Was he involved? Did he tell you to find my sister and me?
I don't know. I never see Sorm. Bad man. Devil.
She wanted to scream. You said you knew I would come. How?
Chanchai. And Senator. And Senator's helper. The hotel room. Juntasa. He told me. He told me it was you.
Dirty Beard.
He was there?
Yes.
How do you know?
He bring a girl for the senator. And then you come. Chanchai told him. Told him to come for girl.
It tracked with what she remembered. The senator told Skullface to get rid of the girl. Skullface placed a call. Matthias Redcroft, the senator's aide, escorted the girl into the adjacent suite. Someone came to the door, beyond Livia's field of vision. It must have been Dirty Beard. And then Redcroft came back, and the girl was gone.
Where? She said, struggling with her excitement. Where did Dirty Beard, where did Juntasa get that girl?
I don't know.
You must have some idea. Where?
Juntasa know. So many place. So many girl. I'm sorry. I'm sorry.
She forced herself to think. Was she in danger? Squarehead said he knew she would come. Did that mean the others did too? No, because they aren't plagued by mortal guilt and its unwelcome insights. Still, she said, did you tell Juntasa you knew I was coming?
Yes.
Shit, she'd been wrong. When did you tell him I would come?
For all of us. That you would come. For all of us. You are our karma.
Okay, then. She'd been right the first time. It wasn't a prediction about where and when. More a prophecy of doom. General guilt, not specific insight. Of course Dirty Beard would be afraid she would come. How could he not be, after she'd left that hotel room and abattoir? But he'd have no way to know how she would track them, or the order in which she'd move against them. She doubted he would waste resources in this godforsaken place, waiting for days or weeks or months on the off chance that she might show up. Still, the possibility that she could have been anticipated was sobering. She was accustomed to hunting unseen. This time, she was expected. Meaning the hunting might be going both ways. She had to keep that in mind and adjust her tactics accordingly. She glanced at the woman in the adjacent bed. Her eyes were still closed, her body still trembling.
Where can I find Juntasa?
Please, I accept my karma. I know why you come. I am ready. Please.
Where can I find Juntasa?
My karma. Please. I can't anymore. Please.
It was horrible. She had thought to threaten to kill him. Now he was begging for it. It was like entering for a judo throw, only to have your opponent turn your entry into a throw of his own. She fought to regain the initiative.
I'll be your karma, but tell me first how to find Juntasa.
I don't know. At work. Headquarters.
She already knew that, and she wasn't going to be able to touch him there.
Juntasa, she said, you said he told you about Chanchai and the senator. How? How did he tell you?
He called me.
The thought of Dirty Beard warning Squarehead and maybe being warned in return was unsettling.
When?
No one talks to me now. Look at me. Look at my karma.
Does Juntasa have a phone, a mobile phone? Do you know that number?
Squarehead groaned and his eyes went to a small shelf alongside the cot. There were a few books in it, some clothes, an old photograph of himself when he was younger and healthy, with a small girl in his arms and an older couple alongside them. A daughter, she thought, and his parents. She should have noticed it earlier. If this all hadn't been so personal to her, she would have. And there, alongside the books, an older model iPhone. She set down the pack, then reached across the bed and grabbed the phone. She pressed the power button, and the screen lit up with a message. It was in Thai, but she could see what it meant. The passcode, she said. Tell me. He shook his head.
I can't. Please. I can only be responsible for my own karma. Please.
She glanced at the photograph on the shelf, then back to him. Tell me, or I'll tell your parents what you did to my sister and me. And your daughter, unless she already knows because you did the same to her. I'll tell them what you are. He licked his lips and shook his head spastically.
Please, no.
Yes, unless you tell me the passcode and show me which mobile number is Juntasa's. He shook his head again.
They won't believe you. No.
You won't be around much longer to contradict my story. They'll wonder why I would invent something so horrible. They'll live the rest of their lives with doubts, their memories of you poisoned, their peace of mind destroyed.
His staring eyes filled, and the tears slipped down his face. It didn't make her feel sorry. It made her feel triumphant. He croaked out four numbers in Thai. She pressed them on the keypad and was in. But the interface was in Thai.
Show me, she said. Show me his mobile number, and if I find you've lied to me, you know what I'll do.
Tears leaked from his eyes.
Please don't tell them. Please.
Which is his?
He reached for the phone. She handed it to him. He tapped the screen several times, then pointed to a name and number. She took the phone and looked. Yes, Preet Juntasa. Her Thai was rusty. But properly cued, she could read it, with an entry for a mobile number. She used the burner to snap a photograph of Dirty Beard's information, then did the same for the recent calls screen and the address book. There weren't many entries. The iPhone might have had other valuable information, and she wished she could have just taken it. But someone might notice it missing. She judged the risk not worth it. Besides, she had the photos. She pulled a sleeve down over her hand and wiped down the iPhone on the sweatshirt. She passed it back to him to ensure his prints would be on it. Not that anyone would look, but if they did, no prints at all would have seemed odd. He took it in his right hand, transferred it to his left, and placed it back on the shelf. She switched the burner to video again.
"Tell me what you did," she said.
He shook his head.
"Please, no more."
You need to confess. You know that. You can feel that. Don't tell me you're sorry if you won't even confess.
Please.
You kidnapped and raped little girls, didn't you?
Tears streamed from his eyes.
Yes.
And your accomplices were Chanchai Vavavapit and Krit Juntasa.
Yes.
Stop hiding from it. Own it. Say what you did.
I kidnapped and raped little girls, with Chanchai Vavavapit and Krit Juntasa. I'm sorry. I'm sorry.
Now in Thai. Say it in Thai.
He did. She recognized enough of the words to know it was accurate. Besides, he was obviously beyond dissembling. She clicked off the burner, dropped it back in one of her shorts pockets, and glanced around. Everything was still silent but for the hum of the machines and the whoosh of the fan. The woman remained insensible. No one else was about. She reached into the pack and pulled on the motocross gloves. She glanced around again. Still no one. Alongside Squarehead's torso lay a spare pillow and an unused blanket. She took hold of the top of the pillow with one gloved hand and slipped the blanket over it so that her hand was sandwiched between pillow and blanket. With the other hand, she pulled free the oxygen tube taped under his nose. Despite all he'd said of karma, his eyes popped panic wide and he fumbled for the tube. Too late. She swept one hand down and pressed his arms to his abdomen. With her other hand, she pushed the pillow over his face. His bony legs kicked feebly. She released his arms and used both hands to compress the pillow against his face. He scratched at her, but his nails danced harmlessly over the blanket, beneath which was the carbon fiber of the gloves. His body began to shake, and he gripped her forearms and tried to push her away. Despite his decrepitude, in extremis, he was able to squeeze hard enough for her to feel the pressure even through the magazines taped over her forearms. But a little pressure through the magazines, even a lot, wouldn't matter. There would be no bruises on her, and no DNA on him. She doubted there would be any fibers from the sweatshirt to be found either, or that anyone would look for them. But even if she were wrong, she had purchased the garment just yesterday, kept it in plastic separate from her other belongings, and would quickly dispose of it. Squarehead's struggles lasted only a few seconds. Then his body relaxed and his hands collapsed to his sides. His knees, which had been pointing toward the ceiling, fell open in a spread eagle, creating a gap in the diaper through which Livia could smell that he had fouled himself. She kept one hand pressed firmly on the pillow. With the other, she moved the blanket back alongside him. She used her teeth to pull off one glove, then the other, slipping each back into the pack with one hand while maintaining the pressure on the pillow with the other. When she was sure he was past any possibility of revival, she moved the pillow alongside the blanket. Doubtless there would be some drool on it, but that would mean nothing. Squarehead's head was tilted back, his mouth agape in a pantomime of a desperate gulp for air, his eyes frozen wide in terror and despair. Maybe in his final moments he'd realized there was something worse than karma in this world. Maybe he'd seen a vision of hell in the next one. She glanced around one last time. The woman in the adjacent bed hadn't stirred. A breeze drifted in through the open door at the far end, but beyond that everything was still. She replaced the oxygen tube, wiped the spot she had touched with a sheet, shouldered the pack, and walked out the way she had come. She felt strangely empty. Seeing his face again had made her want to tear him apart, the way she had Skullface. But in the end, she'd dispatched him with not much more than euthanasia. It was the right call. It couldn't look like murder. You'd be a suspect. Dirtybeard would know you're coming. You wouldn't get to Sorm, the brains behind what happened to you and Nassan. And you'd never find that little girl. You killed him. After all these years, you killed him. Let that be enough. But what if it isn't enough? She'd spent 16 years, almost half her life, craving revenge, and killing the senator and his aide, and most of all Skullface, was sweet. It was. But all that had been only 2 months earlier, and now she was back, and it wasn't helping the way it had before. What if it's never enough? It has to be. It has to be. But all at once, she didn't really believe that, and she had no idea what that meant, or what to do about it.
Chapter 10 Docs woke at first light in the small room he'd taken at the Blue Bat Hotel in Bottom Bang. At the real equivalent of about $20 a night, the place was cheap enough to take cash and accept a story about a lost passport, but decent enough to have solid doors and locks, and overall it was more than comfortable. The bed was nice and soft, the way he liked it. He'd spent enough nights in cramped sniper hides to appreciate a good mattress and feather pillow.
But despite the furnishings, he hadn't slept well. It was the feeling that he should get the hell out of Cambodia. If Rain knew he'd stuck around after a job, he would have told Docs he ought to have his head examined, and Docs knew he wouldn't be able to argue. And job, hell, it was more than that. He'd killed the guy who hired him, a guy who turned out to be, oops, a DIA officer up to his neck in unspecified skullduggery, and three accomplices right after, and now there was a damn sword guy on top of it. The problem was, there was at least some chance Sorm would turn up in Cambodia, and Docs didn't want to cross a border only to learn that he had to go back right afterward. On the other hand, according to Van's hunch, which Docs had relayed to Kamizaki, Sorm was likely in Pattaya. So he'd compromised, taking a late bus to Battambang, a city northwest of Phnom Penh with a laid-back vibe, some remarkably well-preserved French colonial architecture, and a name Docs had always secretly loved. Battambang would give him reasonably good access to Pai Lin, Sorm's home province, as well as to various border crossings into Thailand, where he'd be within shooting distance of Pattaya, figuratively speaking, if Kamizaki wound up confirming Van's hunch. He headed down to the hotel restaurant. It was far too early for the hotel's trekker clientele to be up, and he enjoyed having the pastel-colored room to himself for a meal of scrambled eggs, tropical fruit, and black coffee. When he was done, he used another burner to call Kamizaki. "New phone?" Kamizaki asked. "Just trying to avoid any more unpleasant surprises." They quickly confirmed the signal ID was a match. "Well, how'd old Van's hunch work out?" Doc said. "As well as yours?"
"Maybe better."
It was hard not to smile at that.
"You don't say."
"I don't want to give him too much credit, but he got me looking in the right direction. Helped me eliminate some false positives and probably saved us a lot of time overall."
"That's good. I'd certainly like to resolve this unpleasantness sooner rather than later."
"Don't get me wrong. This wasn't easy. At all." Docs laughed. Kamizaki couldn't stop himself. He always had to remind you of how difficult the task was so he could exact some greater concession in return. "When this is over, I'm going to send you a bouquet of roses and give you a big, wet, sloppy kiss. But for now, could you just tell me what you found out?" "All right." Van's sense that a Sorm front company was investing in that deluxe hotel in Pattaya was key. I pointed some financial forensics people in that direction, and they uncovered connections Van hadn't managed to. "And then? This is the good part. In the last week, the same period Van told you Sorm has been in the wind, a dozen calls have been made from a dozen burner phones, all from the nightclub in that hotel, all to known Sorm associates."
"Son, I don't just appreciate you. I think I love you."
"Wait, that was only the good part. Here's the best part. The mobile phone of one of said associates has shown up in the club 3 times in the same week. Not proof positive, but about as solid a trail as we ever get in this business. Sorm is there, and he's meeting people." Docs took a sip of coffee, suddenly suspicious.
"Yeah, it sounds solid, all right. A little too solid, you think?"
"I had the same thought, but I really did have to work a lot of angles to get this intel. Sorm doesn't know all our capabilities. You wouldn't believe how many bad guys out there are careful about their own phones, but don't think about the patterns created by the phones of known associates. And sure, Sorm is being careful, but he also knows he's being protected. Maybe that's making him more complacent than he should be." That did sound about right. It just always made him twitchy when a trail seemed a little too easy to follow.
"All right," he said. "You've convinced me."
"Now listen," Kamizaki said. "The intel is good, but you need to be careful. Sorm's not just a monster. He's a survivor. He'll have heard about Gant. I doubt he'll be out in the open, and I expect he'll have bodyguards."
"I expect the same," Doc said. "Speaking of which, sadly, I had to ditch the SR-25 Gant had procured for me after I sent him to his reward with it. So other than my usual collection of exotic, sharp, and pointy things, I'm feeling a little light on tools at the moment."
"No. I can't help with that. Whatever else is going on, Sorm is a DIA asset. You can't kill him. I can't be part of that. It's a bridge too far."
"Look, I already promised Van I wouldn't kill the man, but I do at least need to have a word with him.
And I'd prefer that word to be Glock, say, or SIG, or ideally Wilson Combat, which, yes, I know is two words, not one, just to establish the right conversational tone. You want him to open up to me, don't you?
There was a pause, then Kanazaki sighed. All right, I'll have something for you in Pattaya. I need to reach out to a contact in the area, and then I'll let you know where and how.
Good, and while we're on the subject, I favor the tactical supergrade in 45 ACP.
What do you think I am, Santa Claus?
Well, you're both miracle workers, right? Oh, and a belly band holster wouldn't offend me either.
Kanazaki laughed. I swear, one day you're going to get me into real trouble.
Maybe, but you know I'll always be there to help you get out of it, too.
Yeah, I do know that. And no bullshit. Thank you.
Docs hadn't been expecting that and was surprised to find himself touched.
Well, same to you, amigo. A lot of water under the bridge between us. I'm glad you know I've got your back, and it feels good to know you've got mine. The only way to make sense of this crazy world of ours is to know who your real friends are.
Kanazaki laughed again, and the unfamiliar emotional moment was gone. Remember, I want to know what Sorm has been feeding DIA, the basis for that relationship, and why they tried to kill Van.
I know, and don't kill him, damn it. I won't. Can't promise I won't hurt his feelings, though.
He clicked off, powered down the phone, and slipped it into the Faraday case.
Yeah, he wouldn't kill Sorm. Not unless he had to. For the moment, Sorm wasn't the real threat. That was the people behind Sorm. So as much as he might enjoy it on a personal level, there wouldn't be much point to killing Sorm without first learning who at DIA was backing him. But he hadn't said anything about killing bodyguards, had he? No, he sure hadn't. Must have slipped his mind.
Chapter 11 Livia spent the next two nights at the retreat. Remaining at the scene was contrary to all her instincts, but she'd reserved for two nights, and leaving abruptly would draw attention. It wasn't logical, but she half expected police to show up. They didn't. Instead, there was a small and dignified ceremony in the chapel for a recently deceased patient. The body was wrapped in red cloth, incense was burned, and one of the friars said a few words. The only mourners, so far as Livia could see, were hospice staff and other patients. Everything about the simple send-off seemed familiar and routine. And why not? This was a hospice for the indigent dying of AIDS. What could be more unlikely here than murder? And what could be more common than another ravaged patient succumbing to the disease? At least she was able to use the time well. With the gossamer, she plotted Dirty Beard's movements. Over the course of just under 48 hours, his primary points of contact were Royal Thai Police Headquarters in Patamuan and a building in a nearby neighborhood called Ikamai, which she learned online was known for its pricey condos. Not the kind of place a Thai cop could ever hope to afford on his salary alone. She wondered whether it was his primary residence or whether he owned it through some sort of cutout. A cop living ostentatiously beyond his means would be a huge red flag in the States. Maybe here, the brass was content to ignore it. As long as they got their piece, too. She edited the confession video down to its most salient aspects right on the burner, then transferred the photos and video using the Tails operating system and an encrypted thumb drive to keep her laptop uncontaminated. After that, she roamed the internet behind a VPN, scouting locations, acquainting herself with routes and distances, judging potential risks and rewards. She didn't see anywhere she might have a shot at taking Dirty Beard by surprise, and she didn't have time to wait for a lucky break. She would have to force him to come to her. The problem was, it wasn't like Seattle, which she knew intimately as a cop and from innumerable weekend rides. In Bangkok, it was the other cops who had the advantage. She could mitigate that through meticulous preparation, find ways to keep them moving, reactive, off balance, the way she would on the mat against a bigger, stronger opponent. If she could take away their base, their footing, all their natural advantages would be neutralized. If. On her second night at the retreat, she tracked Dirty Beard's phone to the Srinakaran Rot Phai night market, east of the city center. She checked online and saw a dense, labyrinthine network of thousands of stalls and pop-up restaurants selling every manner of books, food, clothing, electronics, and assorted arcana. From the night market, he headed south all the way to Pattaya, a beach town on the east coast of the Gulf of Thailand, arriving at a new hotel called Ruby. It was nearly a 2-hour drive from Bangkok, and whatever he was doing there, she expected he would stay the night. But when she checked upon waking the next morning, she saw that he had turned around after only about an hour. She didn't know what any of it meant, but it would likely be useful to have 2 known points of contact by which to interrogate him. She left later that morning, thanking Brother Panit for a wonderful experience that had allowed her to at least temporarily clear her mind of her everyday concerns. "You must come again," he said as they waited for the cab he had called her. 2 days is good for the spirit. 2 weeks is better, or longer. Many people have stayed with us as volunteers, caring for the dying. Like St. Francis, most of them have found the experience transformative." She smiled, recognizing from the natural diction that the speech was practiced. Not that she doubted its sincerity. "I can imagine," she said. "And, by the way, was that a funeral I saw yesterday?"
"Oh, yes, Mr. Sakta. He came to us 3 months ago. He speaks very little and I think had so much sadness. But he is at peace now."
"I hope not," Livia thought. She wanted to ask more about Mr. Sakta's visitors especially, but knew too much interest would look strange and would be too memorable. 2 hours later, she was back in Bangkok. She'd kept the room she took in the Sathorn Business Hotel after arriving from Seattle. She was in town practically on official business, after all, so she was using Genuine ID at check-in and credit cards to pay. Anything else would have looked odd. For the same reason, keeping the room made sense. For anyone looking, it would seem as though she'd been in Bangkok continuously, and she wouldn't have to account for the 2 nights she'd spent at the Franciscan retreat. She'd left her personal cell phone powered down at the hotel. If someone were tracking it, it would look odd that it had been off for 2 days, but that was better than someone using it to follow her to the scene of Squarehead's demise. There were a few work messages, and one from B.D. Little left the previous evening asking that she call him back. Before leaving, she'd signed up for an international plan, call anywhere from anywhere for 30 cents a minute. She didn't know where she'd be reaching him, but if he were in the States, it would be the middle of the night. She didn't care. She pressed call back. She waited while the call went through. Then, "BD here." She had been expecting something like, "Hello, Livia." He didn't recognize her number? She wasn't buying it.
"You called?"
"I did. You're a hard person to reach." She didn't like the sound of that.
"What do you mean?"
"I guess your phone's been off." She had interrogated enough suspects to recognize when a cop was fishing, and to know better than to respond with anything the cop could then use.
"I'm in a new place, lots to see."
Neither confirming nor denying that the phone had been off, essentially saying nothing. "Oh, I get that. I can be the same way when I travel, but I'm glad we're talking now."
She didn't respond. The less you said, the less you had to explain.
"Anyway," he went on after a moment, "how's it coming out there? You feel like maybe you want to be on the team?"
"I'm not sure yet. I've only been here 2 full days.
"Of course, of course. But I'd love to hear your preliminary impressions."
"I'd rather absorb a little more and then issue a final report. I don't want to get your hopes up prematurely."
He laughed. "Okay, fair enough. Just don't forget to check in from time to time, okay? I like to be able to reach the people I'm working with."
"You're not working with me. At least, not yet."
He laughed again. He put up with a lot of pushback. Either he was an exceptionally affable person, or he really wanted her. For what, though? "You are tough. But okay, fair point. Thanks for calling, and I hope the trip goes well." He clicked off.
There had been a slightly false note to that, "I like to be able to reach the people I'm working with" line. If she didn't know better, she might have thought he was trying to get her to think that phone calls were his only way of being in touch with her.
But if he had a Gossamer himself, and of course he would, he'd be able to monitor her cell phone's movements. Gossamer, hell, he probably had people who could hack the mobile phone company's own database, or who were receiving the data with the mobile company's full knowledge and cooperation. Well, no problem so far, because she'd left the phone in the hotel room as a precaution.
Yeah, but then he knows what hotel you're staying at.
She realized she should have powered down the phone before arriving at the hotel. Something else occurred to her. Had he called the hotel in the middle of the night and told someone to put the call through to the room? I'm sorry, sir, your party isn't answering. Explainable, of course. I was wearing earplugs, didn't hear the phone. But Little wouldn't ask for an explanation. He'd assemble the pieces quietly and draw his own conclusions. She remembered Lieutenant Strangeland's admonition. There are depths to this thing, I know that. I can't see them, but I feel them. And if I'm not seeing them, then neither are you. Shit, she'd been complacent. She considered what else she might have overlooked. Could you be under physical surveillance? That was a sobering thought. On the one hand, probably not. On the other hand, how had Little put it? We have so many resources to waste. She hadn't been followed to the Franciscan retreat. She was sure of that. There had been long stretches on those secondary roads where there wasn't another car in sight. But she had to be more careful. She had to assume she was being watched. She went out, leaving her cell phone behind again. After an hour of tuk-tuk rides, BTS SkyTrain station changes, and two river crossings, she was sure she didn't have a tail. Maybe she was being paranoid. Still, it would be smart to get a room at another hotel, keep the first one, crash at the second, just in case. She found a mobile phone vendor and bought a new burner. At a place called Rocket Coffee Bar, she uploaded the photo of Squarehead's mobile phone contacts and the video of his confession from the old burner to the new one, purging and then tossing the old one in a sewer after heading out again. She'd connect the new one to the cellular network and the internet later, far in time and distance from where the old one had been permanently switched off. She paused to check the Gossamer. Dirtybeard was at headquarters. From where she stood, he was only a couple of kilometers away. She wondered if he'd heard that Squarehead had died, and if so, whether he suspected her. She realized he could find out. A cop calling the retreat center, speaking with Brother Panit, asking whether an American woman of Thai ethnicity had visited recently. It doesn't matter. You're going to tell him yourself. There was a motor scooter dealer right next to the hotel, and she rented a Suzuki Nex, a toy compared to the Street Fighter, but perfect for getting past, through, and around Bangkok's legendary traffic. She spent the afternoon reconnoitering, and as the sun was setting through the polluted haze in the western sky, she rode out to the Rat Phai night market, the evening breeze a mercy on her damp T-shirt. She was curious, of course, because Dirtybeard seemed to have business at the market, but her primary purpose was a vehicle. The market had opened only an hour or so earlier, and the parking lot wasn't yet crowded. She left the scooter and went inside. The density of the place was staggering. There must have been 2,000 colorful tents, all crowded together over several acres at least, surrounded by shipping containers and trucks and brick and corrugated metal buildings. She wandered for over an hour, the smells of fried rice and braised pork surreal on the night air, like a memory from her childhood calling from a reanimated past. When she felt she'd seen enough, she went back to the lot. There were numerous small delivery trucks parked along the curb. She came across several possibilities, but she was looking for something just right and took her time before she found it. And there it was, double parked, this one old and dilapidated, two seats up front, windows rolled down, windowless cargo area behind. The hatch was open, and though the dome light seemed not to be working, she could see the cargo area was half filled with crates of vegetables. A shirtless Thai man with long, stringy arms was hustling back and forth between the truck and the night market entrance, where he would disappear around the corner and then return a few seconds later, moving fast and breathing heavily, beads of sweat running down his back and chest. Obviously, he was making deliveries to some of the food stalls. Livia glanced inside the truck as she passed and saw what she'd been hoping for, the key in the ignition. Based on what she'd seen in the cargo area, she estimated the man had another dozen trips. He was already winded. His pace would likely slacken. It did. She watched from the shadows beyond a streetlight, obscured by passing crowds, as the man went back and forth